The Puzzle Factory. When my studies at the university ended each spring for the year, I would return home, 45 minutes away, to work for the summer. My hometown was, when I lived there, a small, sleepy prairie town, and it remains virtually unchanged today, 2 decades later. For me, while it was a small town, it did have an abundance of summer job opportunities perfect for students. Getting a good job, for the most part, meant getting a good paying one that gave you money to fund a summer of drinking. The best job in town, because it paid well, was as an orderly at the School for the Mentally Challenged. Regular staff took vacation during the spring and summer months, and school officials replaced these staff with university students. It was a long-standing tradition. The locals called the hospital and residence by its truncated name, simply the school, or euphemistically referred to it as the Puzzle Factory. The origin of the nomenclatures is still to this day all but lost to perpetuity, and with it the hazy logic of its supposed comedic value. Perhaps the denizens of my hometown had a lock on irony. The school is actually a campus that has grown from a single home, the home for incurables, to over 100 acres of green space, which hosts a farm, recreation areas, major paved roads, and an assemblage of sandstone and granite buildings housing thousands of mentally challenged residents. It remains today, as it has for well over a century, to serve as home to all varieties of mental retardation. On campus are residences, or cottages, for the mentally challenged who might be transitioning into an independent living situation. For the mildly retarded to severely impaired, there are rooms and common eating areas and several 3 to 4 story buildings. The buildings themselves are stratified wards and levels of severity. The easiest situation for a student was to work in one of the cottages. It was a summer of ball games, movies, and beach trips. The hardest ward was East Grove, home to babies born, some said, of a lesser god. The summer was spent holding deformed babies in your arms and crying over their enlarged skulls or the flippers that lay crooked from their bodies where arms and hands should have been. My brother worked in that ward as a psychiatric nurse and told me there was nothing sadder in the world. My sister worked at the school too, and my mother made a career working with the mentally challenged. In 1966, playing catch with residents, my mother was hit in the eye from a wayward baseball toss and was irrevocably blinded. She stayed with the school 30 more years teaching mute residents to speak using pictograms, aptly called Bliss symbols, for their inventor, Dr. Bliss. To this day, we jokingly call my mother Deadeye Dick, and she laughs. The summer of 1984, I was hired as an orderly on the West Haven Wing, the wing of geriatric female residents across the way from East Grove. On West Haven, the mild to severely retarded women were bathed and fed. They lived most of their lives in its antiseptic hallways and common rooms, being attended to by a corps of nurses and orderlies who helped with everything from wiping away excrement to the allotment of medicines required to keep complete and utter terror at bay. Every part of the day was understandably scheduled, partly to institute a sense of normalcy, but also in deference to bowel movements, the barometer of health for those who could not communicate their aches and pains. Bathing occurred each morning for a different segment of the population of some 50 residents. Then it was on to breakfast and a morning activity. The afternoon was for medical checkups and therapy. There was lunch, afternoon naps, and instituted bathroom visits. Dinner came early, and bed couldn't come soon enough. The night shift was serene and dreamlike. The residents of West Haven fit together like a family and were separated into sleeping chambers based on myriad criteria, level of challenge first and foremost, but this came second over the years to resident companionships. They slept together in smaller wards within the ward, each room comprised of perhaps 6 to 10 beds. It was institutional, to be sure, but made comfortable with wall art and special blankets, although nightstand ephemera was kept to an utter minimum, given the penchant of some residents to swallow almost anything. At night, one of the more important jobs was conducted, and it was an oddly tranquil procedure compared to the fits against taking a drug or spoon of soup, or their anger at having a bath on a sleepy morning, which reached epic proportions. The night shift orderly was to gently bathe the sleeping residents, who on their own could not turn over in bed or separate their own legs. Bed sores were the worry. It is hard to now remember, some 20 years later, the names of specific residents I attended to that summer, even though I washed their bodies in a cooing voice and combed their thin hair with my fingers, even though I was in charge of when they went to the bathroom and what happened afterwards. Still, it is hard to recall their names. Tukey, Big Beth, Kathleen stick in my mind, but few other names. I recall the faces, a few of them angelic, but distorted, with hydrocephalic foreheads, split lips, and mottled skin. But their eyes, reasonably, came back to me for their startling brilliance, even on drugs, and for their alertness and their knowing. I remembered those unsullied eyes, their unbridled laughter following flatulence, and how surprised I was to hear a woman speaking to me and startling me because I had thought she was asleep. I had been watching her, and she had said, "You're my boyfriend, right?" To which the only reply, following a gulp of air, was, "Tukey, you know you have my heart." That early summer, I was seeing my best friend's seven-month pregnant girlfriend, Teresa. Jay had left Teresa when she told him she was pregnant, and he wasn't in town for that summer after taking a job on a highway construction crew. Teresa and I remained friends, and one night in June at a party down on the banks of a muddy river, we found ourselves alone, in the waning darkness, sitting on a sofa that had been ditched in the grass. We were watching the sunrise. Drunk and probably stoned, joking about babies and sex, we leaned into one another to rejoice the dawn and found our lips meeting. We kissed, but not for long. We were talkers. We made some kind of pact following the kissing, a pact that can only come as the result of sleep deprivation, endless cigarettes, and Led Zeppelin. The pact was that we would take care of each other that summer. We had Jay in common, and our highly cynical and acerbic wits. We both loved Jay, and we could make fun of him and the situation together. We both found it hard to figure him out. Over a few weeks, Teresa and I went everywhere together. After work at the school, we'd hook up at a lounge or a bar and dance ourselves silly. Teresa resembling a fat duck flapping its wings, me a gyrating lunatic with sweat pouring down my zonked-out face. We loved to dance. People brought us drinks and said great things about us. Everyone knew, of course, that the baby and Teresa had not come from me. One late night, we talked about making love. Licking or sucking on her breasts was out of the question, but intercourse wasn't entirely implausible. But we couldn't figure out a way to do it without my weight somehow impinging upon Teresa's protruding stomach. After a few bowls of marijuana, Teresa sat on a desk chair and slouched down in order for the legs to rise, part, and rest on two chairs opposite her at a 45-degree angle. The space beneath and between her legs gave me ample room to move, as it were, we rationalized, while not interfering with the baby bulge. I had to crawl beneath her legs and come up between them in much the way an obstetrician might position him or herself between stirrups for the baby's birth. This image was not lost on us stoners. We both burst into great peals of laughter. It was silly. It didn't seem right. We didn't fit together. We didn't fit together that way. We were not in love. Teresa laughed so hard she wet her pants. No matter where she is now in the world, no matter what she is doing, I picture her slouched in a desk chair, legs either side of me, wetting her pants and laughing her ass off. I hope she knows it is a beautiful thing that I see, her face, her tears, that laughing. At work, the once serialistic oddness of the job gave way to a banality best illustrated by conversations over mugs of coffee and burning cigarettes during a work break. How was Tukey's, the question would be asked about a patient's stool. Soft, might come the response. Dark, was usually the follow-up inquiry. As bark, came the reply. In my memory, those conversations remain along with a few episodes like the morning mayhem of bathing the ladies under bright lights and squeals. But also there remains memories of pushing back in a resident's prolapsed rectum and the horrific vomit and shit projections. Mealtime was easy, enjoyable thing to remember. The ward had a rather large dining room for the residents who sat in groups according to diet and degree of need in eating assistance. Food was delivered from a central location on carts, but the dishes and cleanup was all ours, especially for the summer orderlies. One dinner I recall fondly. It was bright, sunny, early summer night. Light poured in the room from its many windows. After dinner, I had been selected to mop the floor and get the dishes ready to be cleaned. I don't remember exactly why, but on this evening I found myself alone. All the other staff were at some sort of meeting. I had under my care two residents, Big Beth and the quiet Kathleen. The dining room has a sound system, so I turned on the radio to help pass the time. As I was mopping the floor, the song Everyone Wants to Rule the World came on, and I began to dance around the tables with my mop, much to the delight of Beth and Kathleen. Big Beth, an Inuit of enormous proportions, propped up in her electric wheelchair, began to writhe and wiggle and squeal with ecstasy. Her tongue protruded, and she squawked a call from her twisted mouth. When she was happy, she'd squeeze her eyes shut, and as I danced about her, moving her chair back and forth to the beat, her eyes were clamped down, her tongue out. It felt like a rare moment, and it was. It is when there is a fluted glory in your chest from the beautiful ache of sun, of mortality, of being one of God's challenged orphans. I danced and kissed the top of Beth's head, and the privilege was all mine, to be sure. But at this, Kathleen screamed as she did, and shrieked as she did, and began hitting herself in the head as she did, and I went over to quietly place my hand where she'd been striking in order that it stop. And Kathleen stopped as she did, because we all knew Kathleen, a woman who was born slow, knew it was wrong to harm a fellow human being. Later that shift, I sat with the chief nurse, Bev. She was the kind of Catholic I liked. In one fist, I imagined her clutching a rosary, and in the other, a beer and smoldering cigarette. Bev disliked the phony Christians who believed the fall never happened. The head nurse was a stout and a hard woman who had everyone's respect because she often showed she had a heart of gold. When the ward was disrupting into turmoil, shit flying everywhere and screaming, Bev would stand legs apart, thrust her arms in the air. This is nuts! West Haven and her women was her life. How do you do it? I asked, thinking of my hand on Kathleen's head. Well, honestly, it has to be done and someone's got to do it, she said to my astonishment. But it seems to make no sense. It's not always possible to find sense here, but you just keep on with it. One day you'll figure it out. It's what we do. They make me a kinder person, make us all better people. We're thankful for what we've got. I wonder why sometimes it's got to be this way, and it's baffling. It is the puzzle factory. Evenings away from West Haven were filled with debauchery and order. I told myself to handle the things I saw at work, the things I did and wanted to do, but felt sad in having to do them. The evenings were all about drinking and card games, beach volleyball in the dark, driving crazy and drunk down corduroy country roads, screaming at throttling trains, and plenty of stupid, meaningless sex, sometimes all in one evening. After the parties and the bars, I would ride my 10-speed through the quiet streets of my town, drunk and elated to be alive. I would fantasize sometimes that on my rides through the town, I would see in the doorway or window of an unfamiliar house, an upright and cleaned-up Big Beth, waving hello to me, or see Kathleen through a window, quietly knitting. It made sense to render the world this way. The soul abhors rough edges. even the finite phrase found on leftover puzzle pieces. I met Renee later that summer. A soccer teammate of mine had invited me back to his house after a game for a few beers. Those few beers lasted well into the night, and shortly after midnight the door opened and in walked Renee. She was my friend's cousin, a model, visiting from the West Coast for a few weeks. Renee was stunning. She was a sylph, with cheeks made of the purest geometry and eyes like sin. She told me later she was sexually enlightened by Cosmopolitan. Renee had an easy smile, and her brown hair fell onto her shoulder in cascades. Her voice was smoky, and her perfect skin was cool to touch when I shook her hand, holding her forearm in a light embrace. She sat with us and joined in our conversation, and it appeared she had absolutely no interest in me. When my friend excused himself to go to bed, I thought the night was over. "Well, I'm off to bed too," she said and rose. I was in the process of getting my stuff together and leaving when she said, "Want to come?" I followed her up the stairs of the turn-of-the-century house to the attic, which had been refinished and turned into a guest room, with not so much in the way of furniture other than a sleeping bag and a suitcase. Light streamed in from two dormer windows at the opposite sides of the room. Everything was steely white. We sat down on the sleeping bag, and as we discussed Nietzsche's madness, we drew closer and helped each other undress. In the light, her skin was the color of skim milk. Her sweet anatomy and pliant regard drew me in deep. It was slow lovemaking, not the kind a college boy is used to. It climbed into darkest apex of night and ended with exhaustion and an ebbing dawn. We parted that morning speaking of kismet. A foreboding aura of inevitability hung over the next 10 days as we were together going to parties, hitting the beach. Our friends spoke of us as if somehow fated to be together. We shared much in common, they said, and they broke it to Renee that I, too, was a model. They produced a flyer for a supermarket, which had a picture of a grocery clerk holding a sack of produce and smiling. "Well, it was me," I said. "It paid the bills." I was lying just a little bit. It was one of only 2 or 3 modeling jobs I got while in college. Renee told them I was the one. I told them that this one was different. It felt like the right fit. At West Haven, the summer's turn continued with great regularity. I learned when each of my residences needed the commode nearby to forestall accidents. I learned what meds were required and how to get the entire ward of staff and residents under general control each afternoon by 2 o'clock in order for the staff to watch the latest episode of As the World Turns. I briefly toyed with the idea of staying on and working full-time as an orderly. Bev dissuaded me of that notion, drawing on her cigarette and shaking her head back and forth very slowly. "Go back to school." Of course, summer came and comes to an end. I cannot now reason it out why I did not attend Renee's going away party. We had spoken about it. We had talked about it. We talked about our future of me moving out to the coast. We were just kids, both 20. But I missed her party. The night before she was to leave, I left the puzzle factory on my bike and drove by the house where she was staying. It was late and the lights were out. I had wanted to let her know that I'd been there, but lacking anything to write with or on, I came up with another plan. I rode around the town and found the choicest flowers to steal, pink and yellow butterfly gladiolus, from in front of the local funeral home, which became the prize. Clutching the batch of flowers to my chest, I rode my bike back to the house where Renee was sleeping up in the attic. I wove the gladiolus through the screen door. When she opened the door in the morning to leave, there would be a cascading banquet of bouquet of flowers. Months passed. My West Haven stint was over. I had returned to the university to resume my studies on the ways of the world, but more importantly, to attend an evening class where I would meet my future wife. One day that fall, a letter came in the mail, forwarded by my mother. Inside was a short note from Renee and a photograph. In the photograph, Renee is clutching to her chest the pink and yellow butterfly gladiolus, torn from the parlor grounds, where my hometown goes to pay its final respects.